covering the Palm Beaches and the Treasure Coast. This is WPBF 25 News, first at 4.
Thank you for staying with us. I'm Felicia Rodriguez.
And I'm Meredith McDonough. A big break today in the case for an attorney killed on the Treasure Coast.
Kathleen O'Toole has live coverage from White City with what happened today. Kathleen?
The case of who murdered a White City tax attorney was more complex than the most detailed IRS audit. Was it this man, John Wilson, who police say killed his own mother and tried to do the same to Ashley Palo, leading to a brutal and bloody scene on Oleander Avenue? Or was it many of Palo's former clients who were said to be angered by bad advice?
This guy did not have many friends. He did have a lot of disgruntled clients.
Now, the Michelle Lockridge, that live-in girlfriend that we talked about, she is behind bars in Indian River County because she violated a probation for an unrelated grand theft charge. We're live in White City. I'm Kathleen O'Toole, WPBF 25.
Fort Pierce, Florida is known for its beaches and amazing sunsets, as well as its high crime rate. One of the most disturbing acts of violence to happen in the area was the murder of local tax attorney Ashley Palo. During a police welfare check, a search of the property revealed a custom hurricane shelter, which had a padlock and a chain on it. After breaking it open, they finally found Palo. He was lying inside dead, wrapped in a rug with a bag over his head. His body was decomposing, and it appeared he and his clothing had been burned with acid. An autopsy would confirm he was strangled to death. Investigators started digging into Palo's life to uncover who would have wanted him dead. They learned he studied at the University of Memphis in Tennessee, met a woman, studied law, and moved with her to Florida, where they married and had kids. They later divorced, but his daughter told police he was a doting parent despite being something of a workaholic.
Most tax pros are workaholics, right, Dominique?
An awful lot of us, Tom. To find out who is responsible for the tax attorney's death, join us on our next episode, Fatal Secrets, the Twisted Saga of a Tax Attorney's Vengeance.
Welcome back to Tax Crime Junkies, the podcast about true tax crimes. I'm Tom, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dominique. In today's episode, we're going to delve into the part two of our podcast episode on the case of Ashley Palo, a tax attorney who went missing and was later found dead, wrapped in a rug with acid poured all over his body in his own storm cellar. Ashley was a successful tax attorney who had been practicing for over three decades and had gained the trust of wealthy clients. He had a good reputation with his family, but his employees had a different opinion. He was described as someone who could be difficult to work with. His ex-wife accused him of domestic violence and filed a restraining order against him in 1995.
Welcome back, Tom. Also, Ashley had a reputation for being aggressive in his pursuit of tax breaks and was accused of being unethical in his tax practice. The story gets even crazier as it turns out he was once charged with murder himself. In 2000, he pushed a 75-year-old man in a deli, and the man died 3 months later due to complications from a broken hip. Ashley was charged with third-degree murder, but the charges were later dropped due to a lack of evidence. During the course of the investigation, investigators offered a reward for information leading to an arrest. Palo did taxes for people and provided legal advice to people in the community. He'd faced legal troubles in the past, including an incident in January of 2010, where he was arrested on charges of organized dealing in stolen property and second-degree theft. Additionally, just 6 months earlier, he narrowly escaped death from John Wilson, who had also killed his mother on the same day.
Now, you would think Wilson's the prime suspect. Unfortunately, he's not the one who killed Palo. He had a rock-solid alibi, He was in jail on first-degree murder charges after his mother died from her injuries. Investigators questioned two current employees of Paulo, Michelle Lee Lockridge and Thomas Barnard. The two were romantically involved. They claimed they last saw Paulo on the Saturday after Thanksgiving, dropping off his car because Paulo had gotten too drunk the night before at a dinner to drive himself home. Now, the stories didn't really match up, though. Barnard said the two went to work on Monday, November 29th, but Paulo wasn't there. Lockridge claimed Paulo was there, but just locked in his room. Casting even more suspicion on the duo was the fact that Barnard and Lockridge both had criminal histories, although Lockridge had a more extensive one. She had recently served time in prison for charges stemming from embezzlement from her employers and was currently on probation, facing 10 years back in jail if she violated her probation.
So here's where we left off. How do you end up hiring a convicted felon who stole from her employers? That sounds like the last person you want to hire.
Dominique, that's why we're talking about this case, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So Thomas Barnard and Michelle Lockridge were suspects in the murder of their employer, Ashley Paulo, from the first week of the investigation. It sounds like Paulo's got this long history of disgruntled employees. Michelle and Thomas had both worked for Ashley for several years. Thomas was his primary salesperson and tax preparer of back tax returns. So you know how there's the marketing that's done, Tom, with trying to target those who are having difficulties with the IRS, right? Back taxes and such. There were lots of calls coming in for that, and Thomas was really good at closing those clients. His girlfriend, Michelle, was Ashley's bookkeeper.
Right.
So they both had access to Ashley's finances, and they knew his every move. Because remember, they're working inside of his home. Outside of work, they lived together with Michelle's four kids in Thomas's mother's house. So remember, when the police interviewed him, their stories didn't line up at all.
Right.
At that time, she started giving other stories and ultimately said Thomas had killed Ashley and she just helped to hide the body. But the police wanted more evidence, so they went ahead and arrested her on probation violation. And once she was in jail, police monitored her phone conversations with her boyfriend, Thomas, from jail. And she made a deal and promised to take the fall for Thomas as long as he promised to take care of her kids and raise them.
You know, Dominique, I've been thinking about this case since we last talked about it, and it's hard to imagine someone being killed by their own employees in their own home. It seems like there are different accounts of what happened between Michelle Lockridge and Thomas Barnard. Michelle's initial story was that Paulo died accidentally during a rough sexual encounter. She called Thomas to help her hide the body. However, police reports show that Thomas was seen purchasing drain cleaner, suggesting he had been more involved than simply just helping to dispose of the body. Now it's time to figure out who actually did it. Last week, we talked about the introduction of a new witness, didn't we?
We absolutely did. Another employee, a tax preparer in the industry. The witness is Christopher Higgins, and he had yet a completely different story.
Why am I not surprised? Why?
But one time he used to work for Ashley, meaning he was also a co-worker of the suspects, and he left and found employment at another tax firm in town.
There's a however coming, though. I feel it. I can just tell it. What's the however?
You aren't wrong. You know, right after Ashley died, both his workers had to go find work elsewhere. Makes sense, right? They lost their meal ticket.
And they ended up reuniting with Christopher. Yes, it is a small town. And I believe that Christopher had also worked previously together with Thomas in yet another tax business in the area. So Thomas was reunited with Christopher. He called the new firm where Chris now worked, looking for a job, came in for an interview at some point, and got the job. Thomas and Chris weren't super close or anything, just a casual co-working relationship. The pair went out for lunch to Chili's on a work day not long after the killing. Casual conversation then took a serious turn when they started talking about, of course, O.J. Simpson.
This is an old case, but it's not that old, Tom. Right. So it's not like everybody's talking about the crime of the century, right? But I have a question. Do we know what they had at Chili's for lunch that day?
That's random, but we actually do. Christopher had nachos and a Pepsi, and Thomas had a steak and cheese quesadilla with a Blue Moon, and talked Christopher into having a Miller Lite as well. So we have a little bit of alcohol mixed into this lunch.
Okay. Well, Chili's has decent quesadillas, and their nachos are bomb. Have you had the nachos before?
I actually like Chili's, although I haven't been there in years, I think. But yeah, the food's pretty decent. So like I said, their conversation kind of took this turn when they started talking about O.J. Simpson.
Right. And Christopher actually sensed that, too. It was kind of awkward, especially when Thomas suddenly announced that he has something to share. He wants to get something off of his chest. So Christopher actually admitted that by now, he'd already heard about the death of Ashley Paulo. So his first reaction was, I'm not sure I want to sit through this. So he slurped down his Miller Lite. He attempted to pay the bill, and he wanted to get out of there as quick as possible.
Well, I guess Tom has gotten to stay somehow.
That he did. In fact, he insisted he had to get something off his chest. And he proceeded to pour out his story. He even went on to explain in detail his reasons for killing Ashley. He claimed that he hit Ashley so hard he believed he broke his jaw. And then he proceeded to choke him with one hand while he was simultaneously checking Ashley's pulse with the other to see when he died. And when he finally died, he put a plastic bag over his head and dragged the body toward the closet. And that's where he went to a gas station and called Michelle. It was the following day that the pair returned to take care of the body.
Meaning he admitted doing it, and this all coincides with what Michelle had said earlier.
Absolutely, because according to his story, he was just trying to protect Michelle. Remember, Tom, she has a record and she's on probation.
Absolutely true.
So here's the thing. The last time Thomas saw Ashley was on Black Friday, and he'd driven to the office home where Ashley lived and worked. He was dropping off his boss's car, and Ashley mentioned to Thomas that someone had been stealing from him. And he was out to get the person. He was betting on Michelle as the culprit, and he was thinking about calling her probation officer to report her for the violation of probation. So you can imagine how that went over with Michelle's boyfriend, Thomas. Right.
Exactly.
So now it's tense. Things are getting tricky here. Remember, she's on probation. If she gets reported for theft again, it's an automatic 10 years back in prison.
So by now, Thomas was feeling guilty. He initially claimed he didn't want Michelle to be punished for his actions. According to this story, he admitted that he was the one who had been stealing from Ashley. So he made the decision to kill him to, quote unquote, protect his girlfriend. He didn't want her to get into any trouble with her parole officer and have to live 10 years without her and get stuck raising her kids. However, the following day, Thomas called Ashley Paulo requesting their final paychecks. When he arrived at Paulo's house, He received a check, and Paolo also requested his cell phone be returned. On the car ride home, Thomas shared this information with Michelle on the phone, and she advised him to go back, return the phone, and take care of things. Thomas then claimed he went back to Paolo's house, they had a heated argument about his missing money, and proceeded to do the murder. Problem is, Thomas asked Michelle for help hiding the body, and now they're both in trouble.
Yeah, that story actually makes the most sense to me, Tom. There was nothing kind of filling in the gaps with Michelle's story, but Ashley is giving it more context to say why there was the reason for this murder, right? And I think we can tell a lot as well from the autopsy report. What did the medical examiner say? And how do we know exactly what did cause Ashley's death?
Dr. Roger Middleman testified in the trial. The summary of his story is that there would have been way more damage to certain bones in Ashley's neck if the strangulation was done with great force, you know, especially considering Thomas's size. There was no sign of damage to his face, jaw, or chest, which should have occurred with Thomas's account of punching him and then forceful choking for minutes.
So he's suggesting that Michelle may actually be closer to the truth?
He actually said he couldn't know for sure. It's just that if the story incriminating Thomas was correct, there should have been more damage to his jaw, face, and maybe even chest, considering the kind of force that willing and malicious strangulation would have required. But the only proof of strangulation is his actual neck.
So I guess what they're saying here, if we connect all the dots, is yes, that based on Thomas's story, because remember, he said he hit him so hard he broke his jaw.
Right.
But I guess if you then look at the body and the jaw's not broken, it causes you to doubt if his story's true. So what happened with Michelle? Because police were monitoring Michelle's phone conversation with Thomas while she was in custody. There's more than one, of course. They're talking all the time. And Michelle made a deal, and she promised to take the fall for him as long as he promised to take care of her kids. And here's the thing. She asked him in a phone call to share the details with her of how the death occurred so that she could sound more convincing.
Well, that was certainly great evidence that they were both in on it, but I think it was pretty clear that Michelle would have been unable to carry or drag the body herself to the storm shelter. It just physically made more sense that Thomas committed the murder. So Thomas was found guilty. The jury convicted him of first-degree murder and sentenced him to life. The death penalty was originally an option, but was later taken off the table. Michelle was charged with accessory after the fact. She's now serving 30 years for her role in the murder.
Why do you think they believe this story over the one with Michelle as the main offender?
Well, so the trial was not without its flaws, at least according to the motion that was raised to set aside Thomas's conviction. There was an appeal.
There was. And the gist of the whole thing is Thomas's lawyer is contending that Thomas never got a fair trial. Boo-hoo. After the trial, Thomas Bernard submitted a request for a new trial, but it was denied. And he also asked for permission to modify his claims by presenting new evidence. Of course, that's generally what you're looking for, right? If you're going to have a successful appeal.
Right.
During a series of phone conversations, Thomas did not fully acknowledge all of the accusations against him, but just simply agreed to Michelle's request for him to do the right thing. So they're saying he didn't really say anything about himself on that call.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, the state became aware of a potential witness named Samantha Freer. Samantha Freer was cellies with Michelle and claimed that Michelle had admitted to killing Paulo during consensual sex through erotic asphyxiation. Here comes this story again. Freer's testimony could have contradicted Higgins' testimony. Remember, Christopher Higgins is the employee at Chili's drinking a Miller Lite. But I think Higgins sounds a little more convincing because he was reporting on Thomas's confession. But the state didn't present evidence to the defense until just before the trial.
But wait, was that a Brady violation?
So they say. So during the trial, Samantha Freer, who claimed that Michelle had confessed to killing Paulo during consensual sex, they knew about her, but the defense really didn't do any work to prepare to put her on the stand. They didn't try to corroborate her testimony. So here you have an ex-con, you know, that's testifying and their credibility is always challenged. And so there was a potential there for a forensic expert to provide support that backed up Freer's testimony. But the defense didn't decide to put that evidence on, and they made a motion, and the motion was denied.
But here's what happened. While arguing for the exclusion of Freer's testimony, the state was aware of another potential witness, Tomalisha McKilver, who had allegedly heard Michelle confess to the crime. However, the state didn't disclose this information until a week after the trial, when the defense requested a new trial based on newly discovered evidence. The state then countered the defense's motion with the testimony of another inmate, Bernadette Perry, who claimed to have overheard Michelle and Freer conspiring to fabricate a confession. The state withheld crucial information about Perry's history of major mental illness, suicide attempts, heavy medication, felony convictions, which could have severely damaged Perry's credibility if disclosed.
This web is getting deeper and deeper. So another liar to prove the first liar and the second liar were lying. It's almost like choosing amongst the criminal cast of characters. Who can you believe?
It's almost impossible to figure that out, right? And without cooperation, the jury has to choose which of these so-called star witnesses that they want to believe. His team was convinced that, according to the law, Thomas had a right to a fair and reliable trial of his case during his first-degree murder trial. Again, the defense's assertion was that a number of factors resulted in prejudice against Thomas, and they argued he was denied that fair trial. Specifically, his defense counsel failed to secure a forensic pathologist who could have challenged the state medical examiner's evidence and provided the jury with evidence consistent with Michelle Lockridge being the actual perpetrator of the crime.
My, how the tables have turned. He uses one defense the first time, and now he wants a crack at it again. Let's try a different story. So we have Michelle. She offers to take the fall. Thomas doesn't use that at his trial, but now he wants to try and pin it all on her.
Yes. So the defense team had hoped that securing a medical expert would have allowed them to introduce Samantha Freer's testimony and the post-trial discovery of Tomalisha McKelver's testimony in the defense case. They believe that if the state had not withheld material evidence, the trial court would have allowed Freer to testify, and the defense counsel would have known about McKelver's existence. Therefore, McKelver would have been available at trial to testify in the defense's case. The defense counsel could have sought a continuance to further investigate Freer and McKelver's accounts of Michelle's confession. The state's failure to disclose evidence and the defense counsel's inability to secure a medical expert prevented the introduction of evidence that could have exculpated Thomas. The defense position is if they had been able to present this evidence, it would have increased the likelihood of a not guilty verdict.
Well, let's go back to the medical examiner, because this is where they're kind of picking apart this testimony and saying, hey, maybe Thomas is lying because we don't see the kind of injuries that he's claiming he put on Ashley. So Dr. Roger Middleman conducted that autopsy, and he observed burn damage, darkening and flaking of the skin, and hemorrhages that had resulted from the pressure being applied to his neck. So that kind of falls in line with what Thomas is claiming, right? The veins over the surface of his eyes had ruptured due to the pressure. They call that petechiae. And the medical examiner noted that there were no bruises on Ashley's face, but there were bruises on the front of the neck. So you did mention that the examiner concluded that the injuries were consistent with the hypothetical scenario that someone had the victim in a chokehold, such as an arm bar across the neck, and then moved to frontal strangulation. So that means that somebody had applied force to the victim's neck, which led to his death. Now, I don't know about you, Tom, but to me, that makes it seem less likely that Michelle did it, because assuming she's smaller than her boss, did she really put her boss in a chokehold? And what about his confession? Thomas confessed to his new coworker. How do they argue against that?
Thomas's defense counsel argued that his confession was coerced and that the state had not provided enough evidence to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. But the prosecution argued the physical evidence, Thomas's own statements to the police, to his friend, Christopher Higgins, that all provided enough evidence to convict him.
Was he coerced with bad nachos? And then on the other hand, we've got Michelle Lockridge, who is feeding her cellies information to come forward and say, oh yeah, I was there too. You know, this guy, Ashley, he was into some weird kinky things and we were all making money off of him together. So apparently she's kind of saying she has her personal experiences with him as a prostitute and drug user. So now she's also kind of throwing in there, this is the cellmate, Freer, she's throwing in there this idea that Paulo was a drug addict. Now, remember, Paulo was pretty violent and he was obnoxious and really hard to work with. So I suppose he could have been a drug addict and that created some irrational behavior. So the defense tried to secure a medical expert to corroborate evidence and allow for the introduction of Freer's testimony in their case.
This is highly prejudicial testimony. When the defense is clearly trying to paint a picture of Ashley Paulo being a drug addict and involved in prostitution.
So that's the whole game of the trial, right, Tom? That's why the prosecution then tries to use the law to keep certain evidence from coming into trial. So if we look at the Federal Rules of Evidence 404, character evidence is inadmissible unless the defense can show an exception under the law. It just stays out. The other thing is that the defense believed that Tom Alicia McKelliver would have been available to testify in their case if they had known about her existence at the same time as the state's belated disclosure of Freer's testimony. But the state strongly opposed the introduction of Freer's testimony, as you might imagine, and challenged the defense's claim at every turn. So despite the fact that we've got all these confessions, to me, it's not really clear why Michelle would want to pin the murder on herself. And it's worth remembering the original story from earlier.
Now, there is a letter written in 2017 by Michelle. We actually have a copy of it on our website. Just check the show notes. In it, she claims that everything she said before was in fear. She did not want her children to be taken away from Thomas's mother's home and taken to live with her ex-husband. And remember that when the kids were eventually taken there, her 10-year-old daughter ended up being murdered. So she had a good reason to fear.
Looks like she did.
But one more thing. Keep in mind, the jury also relied during trial on the Christopher Higgins story, especially since the autopsy was saying something a little contrary. Remember the phone calls in jail?
Yeah, it's so hard. This is crazy to even keep everything straight.
It definitely is.
So the appeal, how's it looking?
Well, let's see how it goes. There is that letter from Michelle denying everything.
True.
Well, Dom, do you remember our murder count on all of the murders connected to this case?
I haven't heard a new one in today's episode, but I do remember, and I think it was about 4 from episode 1, right?
Right. So there was Ashley Paulo, Wilson's mom, Michelle's daughter, and who else?
The guy from the deli.
Right. The guy from the deli.
And as if this story couldn't get any crazier, Chom, check this out. So Ashley Paulo's our tax attorney, right? His date of death is near the end of 2010. And when he passed away, he was 68 years old. Strange thing, but years before this, Ashley's brother Adam was killed when he was 29 years old and attending Memphis State University. Now, Adam suffered a mental illness episode and he was killed while in police custody.
You mean the police shot and killed him?
Yes. You want more crazy?
Let's do it.
I mentioned Ashley had 4 kids, right? Well, in 2021, Ashley's son, Matthew, was shot and killed by police when he was just 28 years old. He also suffered a mental illness episode, and police killed him while attempting to take him into custody. Now, Matthew had called 911 and asked for help. He said he was having a mental episode. He wanted to be committed to a hospital and put into a psychiatric facility. And it ended up escalating and he got shot and killed. So Ashley's family received between $400,000 and $500,000 from suing the city of Memphis after his brother's death.
Did Ashley's ex-wife sue over their son's death in 2021?
They did, and they recovered over $500,000.
How is it possible there is just so much murder around this guy? It's so strange.
You're right. And I think there's a few takeaways we have from this episode, the least of which is, you know, if your boss is acting a little strange, you probably should not stay working there.
Right.
And the same thing goes for your coworkers, right? But I think the theme there is the importance of workplace dynamics. This is a story that highlights the potential dangers of toxic work environments. I mean, we talk all the time about, oh, it's toxic to work there. I don't feel good when I'm working there. But when you've got employees that feel undervalued or mistreated, now, I'm not saying it's right that they should commit murder, but
of course,
which do you think is less of a risk of you being murdered as the boss, right? Where you have a valued employee that feels heard, that's happy with their employment. So it does serve as a reminder to create a positive workplace culture and one that's surrounded by respect, communication, and fairness.
What about signs of distress? If we look at this case from start to finish, there were just signs of problems throughout for years going on. And so people's mental health was declining. There seemed to be a high level of stress. I just think it seems overall that, and I don't know if you agree, Don, it seems like Ashley could have been suffering from some sort of mental illness.
Yeah, actually, that part is pretty clear. I do believe he was probably suffering from a mental illness of some sort.
We also need to talk about the consequences of betrayal. The story really delves into what happens when you betray people or mistreat employees. And it really serves as a cautionary tale about the escalation of conflicts and how, you know, we really need to think about de-escalation, resolving conflict, not only in professional relationships, but personal ones as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, this kind of goes into conflict resolution is preemptive measures that you can take to protect your tax business. I mean, maybe Thomas and Michelle wouldn't have been considering murder if they never worked there to begin with. So a very simple background check could have been performed by Ashley, and he would have thought, you know, these are not the ideal employees to be working in this environment. And finally, uncovering the dark side. You can't always tell. I think sometimes these stories are intriguing because there seems to be someone with bad tendencies among us and we don't know, right?
Right.
But the story kind of sheds light on the potential for darkness that can exist within individuals. And I think we really have a need, especially in this country, for systems, mental health resources, outlets for coping with negative emotions. It really highlights the importance of early intervention and seeking help for oneself or others who really may be struggling. And the irony is that the ex-employee is the one that got this all going simply because she noticed she hadn't heard about him in a few days. Right. But what if she didn't notice? Right. Or what if she was a disgruntled employee and just moved on? Who knows how long it would have taken for somebody to realize that Ashley was even missing?
You know, ultimately, I think the key takeaways from this story really focus on promoting empathy, understanding, and the importance of having healthy relationships in both the personal and professional spheres.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for following us up to this point. I hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as we have.
Oh, don't make us sound creepy, you know, enjoying telling the stories of all these crazy murders.
Well, I like the puzzle, right? We're putting the pieces together.
I mean, it's an intriguing tale. I can't argue with that point.
So you want to hear more stories like this? You might want to click the subscribe button so that you don't miss out. And also, don't forget to like and share this episode. And please, tell us what your thoughts are. What do you think will be the fate of the appeal? Which side do you believe? And have you had some crazy experiences with employees working in your tax firm? We want to hear from you. You can contact us at taxcrimejunkies.com. So this is where we call it a day for now. We'll see you on our next one.
We hope you'll join us again next week as we continue our mission to find the loopholes that went left and close them for good. Until next time, remember, every crime has a trail that leads to the truth.